better be watching. You better be watching in the dark. You better be watching.
Mr. Pearson invited me into the house, and I thought for a second, knowing what I know now, I could have been the fourth bag under the house.
I was the main witness. I had to tell them about everything that I found, and that I felt that they were under the house. And stared at me, stared me down, and I just looked right back at them.
I'm Sonia Paz.
And I'm Mara Kospczyk.
And we are your host of Investigated.
This podcast describes scenes of true crime details and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please be advised.
Hey there, everyone. Welcome back to episode 5 of Investigated. And of course, I am here with my fabulous co-host, Mark. How are you today?
I'm fantastic once again, Sonia. How's it going today for you?
It is going. It's been productive, and we have so much stuff to talk about again today.
And I wanted to report to you that we have a lot more listeners than we had when we started, and we are being listened to in about 5 different countries, over 150 cities, and in roughly 30-plus states throughout the United States.
Cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. And of course, we always appreciate everyone's listening and sharing of the podcast and telling others about it. With that said, if anyone out there wants to give us a 5-star review on Apple iTunes, we won't argue with you because it gets the podcast out there and it gets us more visibility and, of course, more acknowledgement to bring the podcast to listeners like yourself, right?
Absolutely.
All right. Let's get into this podcast.
I'm going to hand the reins over to you today because this is your wheelhouse of your expertise. Because if everyone remembers, we spoke last week about Pearson's Garden of Evil. Oops, I'm sorry. I meant Garden of Eden. And we learned a lot about what was the reality in his mind versus what the reality was that happened in court during the trial. So, Mark, take us on sort of the timeline of what happened, and we'll even just focus on the pretrial today. What do you think?
So, thanks, Sonia. I'm glad you think that this is my wheelhouse. It kind of is because I've been doing it for so long. So, what we're going to do is give a timeline of what happened after Biloxi. I'm going to go back a little bit to give you some dates, and then we're going to go through all the court hearings and then how the process works. So one of the first dates that's important is September 22nd, 1969, when Pauline leaves her work for lunch at Kitty World, and that's the last time that her boss sees her there. The following day, so September 23rd, 1969, Pearson ends up going to her work and telling her boss that there was an emergency in the family and that Pauline had to leave with the kids to go back east. He apparently picks up the check, cashes it, and then leaves. The interesting thing here is that on that same day, he contacts Mary Wingate, who we have already spoken to, and she's given you a rundown of what happened there. He then stays for 4 days or so in Santa Clara, and that's when he disappears. Then we fast forward to his arrest. He was arrested on June 27, 1979, in Biloxi, Mississippi. He was then transported to Gulfport, Mississippi, where on June 28, 1979, Lieutenant Harry Burns and Detective Macer go to Gulfport and pick him up to extradite him back to Santa Clara.
So that's what I find really fascinating. And I know a lot of folks that listen to true crime podcasts know what this timeline means and what these different stages of the, you know, processing process is for people that have been apprehended or arrested. But for those that don't know, why don't you just take us through sort of the process of when they're arrested, then what happens?
I'll do that and I'll be quick because it's actually pretty straightforward. So when a person's arrested, they have, meaning they, the district attorney of whatever local court they're arrested in has 72 hours to file charges against the defendant. Once charges are filed, the defendant's arraigned. And then after arraignment, they have 10 days to go to prelim. Prelim is a mini trial where the judge decides if there's enough evidence brought by the district attorney's office to go forward to trial. So you have that 10-day window to do that. Now, if the client decides to waive time, they can waive time on that and they can keep waiving for months and months and months if they want to. But what happens in this particular case is from the time he's arraigned to prelim, you then have 60 days to then go to trial after your prelim court date. So what we have here is Lieutenant Burns brings him back to Santa Clara sometime after June 28th. He is arraigned, and then within a month, July 27th, 1978, he actually does go to prelim, and the prelim's conducted. And he is found to be held over, which means the judge believes there's enough evidence there to hold him over for trial and have a jury decide his fate. There are several dates then that we have going after July 27th. There's a August 3rd, 1978 hearing, I believe, to discuss the prelim. And then there's an information arraignment on August 8th, 1978, where Pearson is rearraigned for the charges that were found to be good from the DA's perspective. Mm. There then is a motion, which in California is called a 995 motion, where the defense puts together this motion to say, look, judge, we know the prelim judge has found enough evidence to go forward, but we believe there's not enough evidence to go forward for the trial. Will you read it and make a decision? That's done on October 6, 1978 and filed. 10 days later, there's a hearing on the 995 motion, and that motion is denied by the judge, which would state that there's plenty of evidence here and we're still going to let the jury decide the fate of Mr. Pearson. What's interesting to me, at that point in time, there's another motion that was done ex parte, which means not in front of the DA, which the defense decided they wanted to appoint an expert to find out whether or not Pearson had any possibility of a not guilty by reason of insanity defense. What they did is they asked the judge to appoint a doctor to evaluate Mr. Pearson and see if there was any usable information from his evaluation to help them during trial. Dr. Douglas Harper, MD, was appointed by the judge, who is weirdly a psychotherapist as well, and was appointed. But what's interesting is he was never used in trial. So speaking from my experience, when we go out and get experts for trial, if the expert comes back and the information that's provided by the expert doesn't fit into the defense theory, that expert's not used. Therefore, the DA never knows about it. Nobody ever knows about it. You put that report in your back pocket and you move on and you try a different defense. So we know that he was found guilty by his jury, and yet there was no mention of Dr. Harper at all. And the DA doesn't even know about that as well.
Why is that? Why did he not know?
When the defense team asks for an expert to be appointed, it's within client attorney privilege that none of that confidential information can be put out unless you use it in trial. So what I believe happened was Dr. Harper evaluated Pearson and found that it was not going to be applicable for an NGI defense, again, not guilty by reason of insanity, because he probably found that Pearson really wasn't insane. He's just psychotic, which is far from being insane. Mm-hmm. We then move on to hearing date of October 30th, 1978, which I believe is just a status conference to find out what witnesses are going to be used, what motions are going to be filed for pretrial. The next date was November 20th, 1978, where both DEA and defense filed their motions for trial. So that was a list of witnesses and then what motions they will need and how many jurors they will prospectively need. The trial then goes from December 4th, 1978 to December 21st, 1978, where Pearson was found guilty by his jury, and then the sentencing was for January 25th, 1979.
Okay.
That's the case's timeline.
Okay. What you and I have talked about before was that the duration of the trial, the timeline that we just covered, is very short. And I did have the opportunity to talk with George Kennedy, who was the former district attorney of Santa Clara County. And we'll go over that in detail later. But one of the things that I had asked him was, why was the process so short from arraignment to trial and that it had only lasted 6 days?
Well, usually the defense waives a lot of time.
Yeah.
But they didn't at all.
He said, from his recollections of that specific part of it, he said, if defense wanted the right to a speedy trial, they could have gotten a speedy trial. So the question is, I guess, did he waive the right to a speedy trial?
And by looking at the timeline, it looked like he waived maybe a little bit of time from prelim to trial, but not much time. Because as I told you before, most murder cases, and this is a triple murder homicide case that goes to trial, nowadays it can take up from a year to 3 years to take a murder case to trial. So this, in today's standards, is very fast.
Crazy quick timeline. And so what happens now?
What we're going to do this episode is just talk about what happened at the prelim, what witnesses were called, what they said. And then we're going to relate what was said at prelim to what we found out may have happened in trial by witnesses. And then we're going to discuss that area. As we know from the timeline, the prelim started on July 27th, 1978. And by looking back at the records and the appeal documentation and the prelim transcript, it looks like that prelim only lasted 1 day. What was interesting is because the burden of proof is on the district attorney, they only call witnesses that are going to be relevant and poignant in this mini trial, so to speak. And so what you see in trial are many more witnesses than what are usually called for prelim. So the prelim witnesses were Paul Carr, John Hauser, Mary Wingett, and Edgar O'Neill Jr. Now, John Hauser is the coroner at the time. Mary Wingett was the witness that we've talked about and we've interviewed already. And then Edgar O'Neill is the FBI agent, special agent in charge, who went to Biloxi and found Pearson and then had Macer come and extradite him back to Santa Clara. The other interesting thing during prelim is the district attorney gives only pertinent exhibits for the judge to look at to prove their case. And how that works is the judge decides whether there's enough evidence to carry over to a trial. And then at that point, the DA then brings in all the evidence during trial, not just a partial list. So the exhibits in this case were just dental records that Dr. Hauser used to identify the three victims. The DA in the case that did the prelim was Stan Voylis, and we know that the defense attorney, N.A. Christensen, was Pearson's public defender, and the judge in the prelim was Judge William Brown Jr. The DA chose to have their investigating officer, Sergeant Macer, there during prelim. And that's usually the case where the district attorney has an investigating officer sit at counsel table to help them go through all the evidence. That also occurs on the defense side where the defense can call their private investigator to sit at counsel table to do the same thing. Paul Carr was the first witness that testified, and he was actually the dentist from Salem, Oregon. The reason they had him testify is because they needed the dental records for Pauline, Paula, and Marianne from Salem, Oregon. Chain of custody issues. So they needed to get those down to Santa Clara. And the way they did that was through their personal dentist, Paul Carr. He testified to the records of all three of his patients, and the records were accurate. So those records were introduced to the judge for review. Dr. Carr did say that there was extensive work done on Marianne, Paula, and Pauline, which the record showed. The next person who testified was Dr. Hauser, who was the coroner and chief medical examiner for Santa Clara at the time. He actually was called to the scene, and we found out through the records that he was also another person that actually crawled down into the crawl space, took photographs of where the bodies were, extradited them from the underneath the house, took some more pictures of them outside, and then also pictures of the remains once back at the coroner's office. He remembered that they were far away from the crawl space and back by the chimney. He testified to seeing three packages all covered in plastic. He described what was a sheet of plastic on the bottom, the three bodies wrapped in plastic, and then another sheet of plastic on top of the three bodies. That's how he saw the crime scene when he went underneath the home.
Right, right. And as you and I both know, the distance from that crawl space to the actual area from the back of the house where the crawl space was, because there was two crawl spaces, one in the back of the house that was accessible from outside, but then there was also one in one of the bedroom closets where it had, you know, one of those little doors that you go in. And that's typically what you do have, but this house specifically had two. We don't know which one he used. However, when they were accessing that area, we did find out that it was from the back end of the house. But it had to have been like 25 or 30 feet. So him to position those bodies into the area toward the front of the house, that was quite a chore. I mean, you're looking at three bodies and the way he positioned them and how they were stacked on top of each other. It was quite a feat to get everything down inside of a crawl space, whether it was from the one outside or the one from inside, to get them underneath. And you have about a clearance of somewhere between 18 to 20 inches or so. That was a lot of effort to get him to be able to get down in there and maneuver these three ladies.
Yeah, I think so. I'm assuming the way he did it was from the inside crawl space. And that would have taken a bit of time, because what you had to do was obviously wrap each body individually, which is what was found by the coroner, and then set it all up underneath the house. And no pun intended, but that's a lot of dead weight to lug around in a small area. And I'm thinking it took him, you know, 7-8 hours to do that. So he had would have needed plenty of time to do that, which was why I'm thinking he did it from inside the house.
Right. Well, I have connected, of course, with the termite inspector who found the bodies that day in September of 1969. And for his inspection, he said that he had accessed it from the outside. So when he accessed that space from the outside, he had actually crawled all the way through and happened to notice from a distance that there was something near where the chimney was located. We'll talk more about that in another episode, but I want to continue to hear what else was said in these reports.
After documenting the bodies underneath the house, Dr. Howes took all the bodies back to the morgue where he reconstructed the skeletal remains, because all of them were in advanced decomposition and they were mostly skeletal. He was able to determine that the bodies were three females, their rough ages were determined, And then from Santa Clara Police Department, he was able to get the dental records from Salem, Oregon, and then complete his autopsy of Mary Ann, Paula, and Pauline. He was able to decipher all the injuries based on skull fractures. And because there were no other physical evidence and the bodies were in extreme decomposition, basically all he had to work with were skeletal remains.
And the dental records.
Correct. And that's how he made positive ID of Mary Ann, Paula, and Pauline.
Holy moly. That's just...
And again, you have to remember that this was back in the 70s where DNA wasn't an issue at all. And this was the only way that they could actually have positive identification were through dental records. Until DNA became the forethought of how we go ahead and identify criminal remains now.
Yeah.
So what Dr. Hauser found in Mary Ann was the left side of her skull had extensive fractures, and also there were neck fractures to her spine. The skull bone fracture in Mary Ann was such that he found the location on the left side was caved in, which then would have ended her life fairly quickly because it caved into the inside of the brain compartment. Whereas in Pauline, there were skull fractures, but they were just fractures throughout the skull. There was no indentation into the brain. It seemed to Dr. Hauser that Mary Ann was hit by a blunt object at least twice, if not three times, because he believes there were three impact sites on Mary Ann's skull. Now, with Paula's skeletalized body, he found no fractures and therefore could not determine a cause of death. It was summarized through testimony and that sort of thing, obviously through Pearson, that he choked Paula and that's the way she died. But other than that, we have no true physical evidence, which is why he determined that Paula was undetermined. Now, Pauline had two skull fractures on the left side as well, and those were her causes of death. He believes that there were approximately two blows to the head from the evidence through the autopsy and the skull fractures. What was interesting to me was the public defender Christensen on cross-examination of Hauser in the prelim. He tried to get the doctor to say that maybe Paula died of natural causes.
What does that mean, natural causes? Of what? Like she had
a stroke or a heart attack when all this was happening. So what I found interesting was that the public defender Christensen on cross-examination of Hauser tried to make out that Paula may have died of natural causes. Hauser said that he couldn't rule out anything because he didn't have a cause of death, but that it was highly unlikely that she died of natural causes based on how the other two bodies were found and that she was young and virile and that probably wouldn't have died from a heart attack or a stroke. But that it was interesting that he brought that up, trying to sway some evidence towards the other side.
That was my question, is a heart attack, a stroke? I highly doubt somebody at the age of 18
would have died of those, quote, natural causes.
Right.
The other interesting thing Christensen tried to bring up was from Pauline's side was that because she didn't have this concave injury like Mary Ann did in her brain, which comes from a blunt force trauma injury, like a baseball bat, any kind of
golf club,
or meat cleaver, meat tenderizer.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to get Hauser to admit during the prelim that Pauline's injuries may have happened with a fall. Dr. Hauser rebutted that by saying the injuries on Pauline's skull were not consistent of a fall because the fractures were so apparent that falling down to the ground wouldn't have caused that. It had to have some sort of blunt force initiated to the skull at that point.
So the theory of her falling down on the ground, I guess you got to give Christensen some credit that he at least tried that angle, but reading it here, it's not, that just seems absurd. Just doesn't seem, not while there were other bodies there in the same vicinity. Unless Pauline was running to the aid of her daughters and fell down and hit her head during this whole scuffle or whatever. But no, not going to fly with me. That nice try on the defense, but no, no way. Not going to work.
So that was basically more than the 22nd version of what Dr. Hauser testified to at the prelim. The next witness that was called at the prelim was Mary Wingate, and we know what she testified to based on her interview with you. But what I found was there were a few things that she brought up during her prelim that I don't think she talked about with your interview.
And what was that? What did you find?
So she basically said that she knew Mary Ann, who she stated was 14 at the time, and Paula, who was 17 at the time, and that Pauline was in her mid-40s, and that she did live next door to them, and that they, meaning her and Pauline, went shopping together. They talked every day because they were neighbors, and that she really didn't see Pearson that often at all. She basically said that even though she saw Pauline every day for this year that they were there together, that she only saw Pearson a few times during that same time period. Now, she remembers and testified to that when they moved, they still kept in touch with each other, but it wasn't that much.
And this was on Woodham's. This is where they got together, was on Woodham's, because Mary Wingate lived two doors down from us, and the Pearsons were between Mary and our house. So they hadn't they hadn't moved to Claremont yet.
Correct. She did say that the last time she had talked to Pauline was about 3 weeks before the murders happened.
What an incredible memory. Gosh, that just blows my mind, you know? That's crazy.
So there was an interesting thing that was brought up during prelim, and that was when they started discussing the phone call that Mary had with Pearson to come clean out the house, the public defender, Christensen, objected, and the judge ruled against him. And what Christensen wanted to do was keep out Wingate's testimony about the telephone conversation because it was hearsay. And that's interesting because a witness can't testify from another witness's verbiage, but there are exceptions to the hearsay rule. And in this case, the judge let Wingate testify to that phone call that she had with Pearson. And that phone call was the one that set up her timeline to come clean out Pearson's house. And we know that she did that for about 4 days.
Wow.
Now, Mary testified to that when she saw Pearson at the house, that she asked him what happened to Pauline. And Pearson said, Pauline's brother was killed in a car accident, and that was in Philadelphia, and that the family had inherited two houses and a slaughterhouse. And that was why there was no need for him to take any of the furniture in their house or very much of their belongings because everything was there at these two other houses. That was the reason why he sold off the furniture. And basically he was gone in 3 days is what she testified to.
But didn't he come back and have her husband work on the car for some reason? I don't think he was able to get out of town because there was an issue with the car.
She did testify that her husband did work on his 1960 Studebaker Lark and did some repair work on there before he left. That's correct.
So he had a Studebaker. He didn't have a Cadillac? Thought he had a Cadillac.
Nope. The testimony was that he had a Studebaker.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Hey, big giant cars, you know, he's just got a, I'm sure he got the latest model that kept him up with the Joneses.
If you recall, in our previous episode, we had talked about the photograph that my dad took of Pearson and the girls washing the family car. So when I look for that and I find it, I will be able to verify what kind of car he had when he lived next door to us. So I'll definitely keep you posted of that.
Right. So Mary then goes on in pretty good detail about how she meets Pearson at the house. He gives her the rundown of what he wants. She notices that the dogs are in the garage, and Pearson looks at her, according to her, and says, you know, I'd really like you to take the dogs because I'm not going to take them. She then proceeded to walk with Pearson to the garage, and the dogs were growling at Pearson, which was interesting. Pearson let the dogs out, and they went running around the side of the house towards the bathroom window, which is by the kitchen window as well, in between the swimming pool. And the dogs started digging right there. Now, she describes the crawl space as having planks on top of it, and that's where the dogs dug. So she picked up the dogs, she took them to her house, and then because she couldn't have both dogs, she gave one of them away to her friend. That's what she testified to.
Well, there's a perfect example of dogs that they know, you know, they love the girls, they love Pauline, you know. Obviously, if they're growling at Pearson, that they know he was up to no good. He had been up to no good.
Well, and here's the interesting thing that she testified to that I don't know if we knew before I read this, and that is that shortly thereafter Pearson leaves, her dog gets away and starts running towards the Pearson house and gets hit by a car. And then
what?
So she then has to deal with this poor dog who was hit by a car and killed.
Oh my God. That's horrible.
Yeah. When I read that, I was like, yeah, what else could happen to this poor family?
Yeah.
Mary said that she started packing up the house, and when she first walked in, the house was in major disarray. She was told to pack up the dishes, the kitchen stuff, sheets, and anything else that was in the house that Pearson didn't want. She said that she took 4 days to clean out the house, but what she found very odd, which I believe she told us, was that when she was looking through the girls' bathrooms and their bedrooms, the girls' makeup were there, their hair rollers were there, all that stuff was left behind, and she found it very peculiar that teenage girls would leave any of that stuff behind. She said there were no clothes there, and there were no photographs, but she noticed that Pearson had thrown all those away in the trash.
Yeah, and, big red flag.
Right. And we know that she testified or told you about the books that she found, but she also found not only the murder mystery books, but she found books on guns and hunting. And she testified, too, that there were probably 30 murder mystery books, all of them highlighting the plot and how the murders were done and how to conceal the murders. She spoke with Pearson about the furniture. He told her that the furniture person was going to come and buy the furniture and pick those up. The furniture person came, which I believe was testified to. This must have been day two or three while she was there. She recalls a telephone call from the school that Pearson received about Marianne missing her second day of school. And they wanted to know if everything was all right.
So she witnessed that phone call, him getting a phone call, or she answered the phone while she was cleaning?
She witnessed the phone call that Pearson was having with the school.
I see.
Pearson then started getting agitated as far as wanting to leave. And day three, he told her that he was trying to leave, but that his car wouldn't work. And that's where we come up to her husband fixing the car on day three. And that was his 1960 Studebaker. Mary also testified to asking Pearson if he would be able to give their new address to her. And he played that off by saying that when he arrived in Philadelphia, he would write her a letter and provide that information to her, which never happened.
Correct. And yet again, this is way back in the day. We didn't have email. We didn't have text. You know, in order to communicate with other people, you'd have to write letters back and forth because phone calls were pretty expensive to do, to call back in the day.
Yeah. One of the last things she did was when Pearson told her, just lock up the house when you leave, because he was out after the car was fixed. She remembers walking through the house and feeling like someone had killed someone there. She said that to herself many times. She looked for evidence and I believe told you that she took some evidence to her home and had it there until the police talked to her.
Yes.
And she found that there was no evidence of any kind of killing in the house that she could see. Well, we know that Pearson confiscated all of the evidence and got rid of it. And we'll get into that later when we talk about the trial. The last interesting thing that Mary testified to was the missing shower curtain. She found that that was strange because why would someone take the shower curtain and he leaves everything else?
Yep. I know. So we heard from the coroner, which was Dr. Hauser, and we heard from Mary Winjet, who gave her testimony. And what's left for the preliminary is from Agent O'Neill from the FBI. Is that what we have left now?
Right. We also had that short testimony from Dr. Carr, who was the dentist from Salem.
So that that tells us a lot, too, is that they lived in Salem for a while. For them to have, I mean, at least a year, or it sounds to me like they might have had a lot, you know, a lot of dental work done between the three ladies. So they had to have lived in Salem for a time before moving to Santa Clara.
That's exactly what I thought when I heard Dr. Carr's testimony, is that they were patients of his for a while. So our next witness was Special Agent O'Neill, and he testified that he was aware that Pearson had a FBI fugitive warrant out for his arrest. We know that he was found by the kid in the post office. What O'Neill testifies to is that he travels to Biloxi. He makes contact with Pearson at Austin's department store. He contacts Pearson, who he knows as George Watson, as the introductions go, and he asks Pearson, after some conversation, if he is Pearson. And Pearson says, no, I don't know who you're talking about. And then O'Neill uses his investigative prowess and says to Pearson, look, I'm going to be taking you down to the station to verify who you are by your fingerprints. I have your fingerprints on this FBI wanted poster. So then we'll know it's you. So it's up to you. At that point, he tells Pearson, you can do it this way or we'll go. Pearson at that point blurts out, yes, it's me. I did it. And what was interesting was O'Neill testified to that he hadn't even talked to Pearson about the murders, that he just talked to him about fingerprints and identifying him.
Right. So he just basically buckles down and starts confessing.
Singing like a canary.
Woo, woo, woo.
So O'Neill, being an FBI officer, realizes that Pearson makes a statement without his rights being read, reads him his rights right away, right there, and then asks Pearson if he would come with him to the station. They go down to the station. O'Neill says that Pearson didn't ask for an attorney. O'Neill says at the station, we're here to talk about the three people, your wife and kids that were murdered. Do you want to talk to me about it? And Pearson basically doesn't say much more other than his first statement, which was that he was the one that did it. There's apparently an emergency hearing that is conducted by Judge Nixon in Biloxi, where they have to do the extradition. According to O'Neill, the extradition was supposed to be done in Texas, but there weren't any judges available. So they had to drive about 85 miles to get to a federal judge to do this extradition hearing.
Really? That's pretty crazy. It's not like that now in this day and age, though, is it like that?
Well, you can fight extradition. He obviously didn't want to. And so, as we know from the timeline, he's arrested and then the next day he's transported. So he didn't fight extradition. On the drive from Biloxi to where Judge Nixon was to do the extradition, there was conversation by O'Neill and Pearson. And here are some interesting facts that this is kind of the first time he's going to set in stone what happens from his perspective. And then we will see how that changes slightly throughout the process of the trial. So Pearson tells the FBI that it was sometime in August or September of 68 or 69, he couldn't remember because he lost track, that he had done the killings. He remembers that he was unemployed and that he was coming home mid-afternoon and that he came into the house where he found Paula and Marianne rolling marijuana cigarettes. There was an argument that took place. Marianne ran out of the house, and that's when he grabbed Paula, scuffled with her in the bedroom, and killed her. That's what he tells the FBI agent. He then tells O'Neill that about an hour later, Pauline and Marianne come home. He grabs a hammer from the kitchen. There's an argument in the living room. There's a lot of screaming going on. He hits Pauline a couple times with the hammer and then hits Marianne at least once. Both go down. He remembers telling O'Neill that he then got sick, threw up in the living room, hid the bodies under the house, stayed there a day or two, and then left. He also says that he then sells his 1960 Studebaker at a gas station in Salt Lake City, Utah. It was interesting when O'Neill testified, he was asked by Christensen if he felt that Pearson was remorseful in any way. What O'Neill testified to was that Pearson was tearful and choked up, but O'Neill did not go as far as to say that he felt that Pearson was remorseful.
Of course he was. Of course. He's just mad he got caught.
I'm thinking that's the case. So that was the testimony of the witnesses at the prelim. The judge came back that same day. Pearson was held to answer, which then moves the case forward to trial. One of the biggest things that came out of O'Neill's testimony is obviously Pearson's confession, which was the backbone of the DA's case. That confession was argued, whether it was inadmissible or not, for hours. And eventually the trial judge said that it was admissible, and then they went on to trial. There was a lot of discussion by the two attorneys and the judge whether or not the manslaughter charge on Paula would stick or whether they would do that as a murder one as well.
In reading the case file, I noticed that there was a lot of discussion about if Agent O'Neill was trying to do questioning about the case, and that was not what was happening. It was the transport. They had all this time in the car, and Pearson decided just to sing like a bird. It wasn't that Agent O'Neill was asking him, because he theoretically could not ask him questions because that was not his case. Is that right?
Right. That's exactly what it was, because O'Neill testifies to that he reads Pearson his rights, I believe, three times. He reads them when he first arrests him, when he blurts out, "It's me, I did it." Then they go to the office where they read him his rights again, and then they read him his rights as they are in court with Judge Nixon to do the extradition.
Right.
So all statements made by Pearson were voluntary. O'Neill never asked him any questions.
Right. Because it was only the FBI was their poster, basically, and that's how these municipalities work, is they're the ones assigned if they were to get the tip, which they did, on any fugitive's location, then they work with the agency in the town for which the crimes took place.
Yeah, and the reason the FBI got involved in this case, because it was...
Interstate flight?
Correct. Very well.
I know. Kind of getting good at this.
So the reason why the judge let Pearson's confession in to O'Neill was, in the legal realm, we call it an excited utterance, which means before a detective or an officer can read you your rights, and they're getting to that point, if you blurt out something, that's still admissible even though your rights weren't read to you, because you still weren't asked any questions pertinent to the crime. And so that's, I believe, why one of the biggest reasons the judge let that whole statement in is because it was an excited utterance, and that gives the officer at that point time to say, well, we need to read you your rights. You have the right to remain silent. You have the right for an attorney, blah, blah, blah. And then he continues on talking, even without any questions asked of him, during this trip from Biloxi to where Judge Nixon is.
Interesting. Well, we will know, because we do have the interview of myself with retired Santa Clara Police Officer Detective Sergeant Monty Macer, and we have a great interview with him. And I will say, just a little teaser here, is that once Pearson got to Santa Clara, I asked Monty Macer, did Pearson talk to you when you extradited him to California? And it was just a big no. Pearson was told to basically keep quiet, which we've talked about before. So that, with that all said, yeah, we're going to dive deep into the rest of the trial for episode 6. What do you think?
Sounds great. We'll also have more information about the trial through the appeals documentation. And that's actually what's interesting, because there is a little bit of difference in testimony and what Pearson remembers.
Right. Awesome. Great time today. Really enjoyed listening to and learning more about this process. And again, I appreciate your expertise.
Thanks, Sonia. And don't forget, join us next week for Investigated.
Awesome. Thanks, Mark.
See you later.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to follow Investigated on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also visit our website at investigatedpod.com to learn more about your hosts, Sonia Paz and Marek Kaspchik. Follow us on social media and connect with us. Investigated is written, edited, and hosted by me, Sonia Paz, with story input and advisement from Marek Kaspchik. And many thanks to the research of criminologist Clark Williams and to Allison Betts Goldman for her contributions to the story. If you'd like to support our show, visit our website. And if you'd like to give us a 5-star review on Apple iTunes, we would always appreciate that, because extra podcast love is amazing. It also helps us get more visibility from fabulous listeners like you. Thanks again, and see you next time.